All right, so we are talking about this guy named Elihu. Or as I said to you, some people say it Elihu, and maybe in Hebrew it would be something like Elihu, something like that. But so I'll probably use all of those different pronunciations at one point or another tonight. And this guy, Elihu, he is quite the mysterious character. He shows up from nowhere. And after he leaves, it's without a trace. It's almost, you remember we talked about the idea of the book of Job is like a musical. And it's almost like you're at a musical, and all of a sudden some guy wanders in off the street, goes up on stage, sings a few songs, and then leaves. And you're like, what's going on here? I don't know what just happened here. And that's the reason why, if you consult various commentaries on the book of Job, people are all over the ballpark in terms of how they understand this guy, Elihu. And since there's no definitive answer in the book, you know, there's no point in the book in which God says he was right or he was wrong. This just doesn't say anything. That means that it's just going to be one of those questions that we're not ever going to be able to finally answer. And that's why it's good for us, if we do see him differently, to talk about what we see and share those ideas, because what each of us sees can kind of help us see maybe a different angle or a different perspective on Elihu. Now, having said that, I wanted to go ahead and put my cards on the table with you last week, and so I told you that I have an extremely negative view of Elihu. But there are other people whose opinion I respect a lot who have generally a very positive view of Elihu. And I told you at the end of class last week, and mean it very sincerely again tonight, the times that tonight I'm going to say some critical things about him, if you see it differently, I want you to certainly speak up and say, well, you know, but wait a minute, couldn't it be this? Because this is just a mysterious part of the book. With all of that said, I do think that by the time we get to the end of his fourth speech, he has four speeches. We studied the first two last week. We'll study the last two tonight. I think we will at least understand why his speeches are included in the book and why they are included at the specific place that they are, because they do serve as a natural segue, a natural introduction into the main point of the book, which is the speeches of the Lord himself. Okay? So, and in fact, I'll just tell you yesterday, Christy was getting treatment, and I was over at Moffitt with her. I actually spent some time going back through his speeches, just kind of looking for, you know, maybe, is there a different angle here? Am I just so blinded by sheer rage against poor Elihu that, you know, I'm excluding pieces of information that I ought to consider? And I think that's always a good way to approach, especially something like this in the Bible that is rather nebulous. Whatever your own opinion is about it, it's always good to say, well, let me try to argue the other side and see how that works. And then you might find that, you know, you do see some things that cast him in a little bit better light. All right, so are there any things that stick out in your mind that we talked about in his first two speeches? What do you think is Elihu's main point, or what are some of his main points that he's making? Clearly, Elihu believes that the friends did a lousy job, although he apparently agrees with them, right? That Job is sinful. He's getting what he deserves, but he thinks the friends did a lousy job of making that case. And so he says, I've listened all I can listen to, and now I'm going to have my say. Yeah, Vicki? Yes, exactly right. He is also outraged, as Vicki says, by the fact that Job makes a lot of serious charges against God, and nobody seems to be able to refute him, and he doesn't want to stand by and see that happen. Yeah, Dave?
Well, he just says, Job, what do you gain from God for not sinning?
Yeah, he likes to ask a lot of questions to Job, and one of them that we're going to really see, especially again, come up to mind is, why do you think God has to answer to you? You know, what are you going to gain by this line of questioning? Yeah, Jim. So now I also heard 75% of all statistics are made up on the spot. So what I want to know is, did you just make that one up on the spot?
Well, that's got a lot to do with the people.
Sir.
If you ask them a question like that, I believe that sometimes I'm able to make an objective thing, but I have to catch myself and say, now, how am I going to answer this? What I think or what... Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it is true. Objectivity is it's a challenge in this book. Job, early on, even admitted, look, these are the words of a crazy man. I mean, what he means is, I'm in such anguish, I'm in such sorrow, you can't take seriously a lot of what I say, and we all know how that feels. And so, yeah, there is a lot of emotion on all sides, like you all just pointed out with Elihu. He says three times in the opening verses of his introduction, he burns with anger over what's taking place. Yeah. All right, well, with all that in mind here, let's just continue right on here in chapter 35. What allegation does Elihu repeat here? He already made it once back in 34:9. What allegation about Job does he make here in the opening verses? Elihu answered and said, "Do you think this to be just? Do you say it is my right before God that you ask, what advantage have I? How am I better off than if I had sinned?" So what is his accusation here about Job? Yeah, that...
He thinks he deserves.
Yes, what he's saying is that Job keeps asking the question, what am I going to get out of this if I serve God, if I fear God? And I pointed out to you back in chapter 34 when Elihu makes this accusation, that the words he quotes are not even Job's words. Job says them, but if you remember, we went back and looked. Who is Job quoting when he says there's no profit in fearing God? And he's quoting the wicked. Yeah. And it seems like Elihu somehow misheard that and says this is what Job himself thinks. Now, the ironic thing about all of this notion that Job doesn't fear God because he doesn't think he can get anything out of it. The ironic notion about that allegation, well, you tell me. What's ironic about that, given what we learned at the opening of the book? That's exactly right. That's what the accuser said. You all said it in stereo. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the very thing the accuser says back in chapter 2. Does Job fear God for nothing? He only fears you because you give him stuff. And ironically, Elihu seems to be making the same kind of allegation here about Job. Look on down in verses 9 through 16. According to Elihu, does it make any difference? Does it do any good to cry out to God in the midst of suffering? Let's just read these verses here. Verse 9, because of the multitude of oppressions, people cry out. They call for help because of the arm of the mighty, but none says, where is God my maker who gives songs in the night? Verse 12, there they cry out, but he does not answer because of the pride of evil men. Surely God does not hear an empty cry, nor does the Almighty regard it. How much less when you say that you do not see him, that the case is before him and you are waiting for him. So according to Elihu, at least with regard to Job himself, is it going to make any difference for him to call out to God and ask God to explain what's going on? No. And this is, I would say, one of the main themes of Elihu's speeches is, no, God doesn't answer. We as mortal human beings are absolutely in no place to call God on the carpet and demand that he give an account in answer to us what's going on. And that's how it comes across what Job is doing, and it is what Job is doing. right? I mean, he said, I have a lawsuit. I want to go to court against God. Job's frustrated that he doesn't think he can do that. And Elihu was saying, you absolutely cannot that because God is not going to listen. All right, so that's the third speech. All right, it's short. The fourth speech, you see, it starts in chapter 36 and verse 1, and Elihu continues. So here's speech number 4. How does he describe his words at the start of this fourth speech? So we've got the luxury of being able to read a lot tonight because we've slowed down our pace considerably. So verse 1, Elihu continued and said, bear with me a little, and I will show you, for I have yet something to say on God's behalf. I will get my knowledge from afar and ascribe righteousness to my Maker, for truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. Well, you know, like I said to you last week, I know an arrogant blowhard when I see one, all right? So this kind of comes across like that to me here. Now, say that again.
He's full of it.
Well, he is. He is full of something, that's for sure. Well, he tells us back in chapter 32 and verse 19 what he's full of. He says in 32:18, I'm full of words. And he says in 32:19, my belly is like wine that has no vent, like new wineskins ready to burst. So he says, oh, I got to say something here. So yeah, he is. He definitely has that. Well, now, so yesterday when I was kind of working through these, I was thinking, okay, if I wanted to put Elihu in the best light that I could, how would I try to deal with these verses here? And I will say this. I think part of what he's saying is somebody needs to speak up for God around here. And that's kind of what he says in verse 2, I have yet something to say on God's behalf. And then when he says, I'll get my knowledge from afar, I really think what he's saying is, this is knowledge from God. That's why it's from afar. It's coming from God. And when he says, one who's perfect in knowledge, well, it's a tough one to make it look great, right? However, I will say this. Whatever exactly he means by this, it kind of rubs us all when you read it, especially out loud. It kind of rubs you the wrong way, you know. And especially because he's young and angry. And now he says he's perfect in knowledge. You put those three things together, that's a tough recipe to be able to put in a positive light. There is one thing, though, I think of interest here. And it's obscured in some of our translations. So let me ask you all, there at verse 4, mine says, one who is perfect in knowledge is with you. Does anybody have a different translation? Ah, interesting. Complete. Not, that's the first part, right? And then what's the second part, Brother Al? All right, so it does. Okay, so it does say perfect. Yes, Irma. Yeah. Right. Right. All right. Yeah. Right. Right. Very good. All right. So now. Dwayne had this note that said complete. And that's what the root of this word means. Like when we talk about a perfect circle or a perfect triangle. And what's interesting is this word is found other times in the book of Job. Let me show you one of them, okay? Look over in chapter 12. And Vicki, I'm sorry, I'll get your comment here. I got to look at this before I forget it. In chapter 12, this is one of Job's early speeches. This is round one against Zophar. And Job says in Job 12 and verse 4, I am a laughingstock to my friends, I who called God and he answered me, a just and, there's our word. And how is it translated in your Bible?
Blameless.
Yeah, that's the word. And it's from the same root as the words used that we emphasized in the very first verse. There was a man named Job, a righteous and upright and blameless man who feared God and turned away from evil. So here's at least what we can say by the choice of that word back over here in chapter 36 and verse 4. The narrator of the book has given us a great claims to blameless knowledge? Job and now Elohim. So just bear that in mind then as we go through the rest of it. That maybe that shaves a little bit of the, boy, he sure is full of it, kind of, you know, impact it may have to us. Yeah, Vicki and then Justin. Yeah, well, I think Vicki's point is, I think it is the best spin you could put on what Elihu was saying here. And I don't mean, when I say spin, I'm not, it sounded bad. I think that's the best way to characterize this. Yeah, that when he says, one who's perfect is with you, what he really means is, because what I'm telling you comes from God, then that's why it's perfect. You know, it'd be like me saying, you know, I'm giving you the 100% absolute truth. Well, insofar as what I say it comes from God, it is. But, of course, that's the whole issue here, right?
Well, I didn't feel like when he said, one who is with you, he was referring to himself.
Right, it would only be him, it would be God through him, right? He would be like the vehicle to that. Yeah, Justin?
That's kind of what I was going to ask you. He's so confident from God. What's his basis of knowledge?
Well, we know the answer to that question. Justin just asked a great question. Why is Elihu so confident that what he's going to say is right? It's the same reason the friends were absolutely confident.
I think it's because the whole perspective that they have is that they are in the position they are because they're right with God.
Right.
And Job's in the position he's in because he's not right with God.
That's right.
And I think that's why he's saying the things the way he's saying them is because the only way he could be so
And what is that principle, by the way? Yeah, the retribution principle. That's why, I think that's why they're so confident. It's kind of like in logic you learn there's a fallacy called the no true Scotsman fallacy. And here's how it works. No true Scotsman would ever eat lamb. Well, I eat lamb and I'm from Scotland. Oh, well then you must not really be from Scotland then. All right, so if you provide any evidence to the contrary, it just is dismissed. But no true righteous person suffers. Well, I'm righteous and I suffer. You must not be righteous. That would be the line of reasoning here. Yeah, Darren?
No, I just wanted to say, I think that's what he was getting at. It's the perfect, you know, the knowledge that he's quoting is what they all think they know of God. Because that's what he goes on to quote. You know, God is, you know, mighty. Does not despise. You know, he just lists this laundry list of things that they all think they know what God is.
Sure. And to be fair, you know, Darren's saying, you know, they're all listing what they think is true. And we've pointed this out before. Not everything the friends say was wrong. They do say some things that are right. Not everything Job says is right. He says a lot of things wrong. We've tried to point those out every time. And that same mix is going to be here. Dwayne? Right.
Or God is not just and good men receive.
Right.
God. But they, Job was brushed over a couple of times, you know, but they never really address how evil men receive blessings.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Dwayne's pointing out that, you know, we talked about this triangle of tension. I didn't put it in this week because I figured y'all are getting tired of looking at it, you know, although I did put a lot of effort into drawing it. But yeah, you know, so you got the 3 points. God is just. Job is righteous. Job suffers. Only 2 of the 3 can obtain so long as this law of sowing and reaping is supposed to answer everything. The law of sowing and reaping is true and always true. Only 2 of those 3 things can be the case. And like Dwayne said, really the only one in the whole book so far at least to ever even question the underlying assumption has been Job. In a couple of speeches, he does make the point, You know, I've seen wicked people prosper. So he's been the one to kind of challenge it, but still not ultimately. Yeah, Justin?
On the second part of it, because of this idea, I always like to look at things in historical context.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, you know, God has never it's logical to think this way at this time because that's how the earth works. You know, if you do things that are good, you're going to reap good things.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, Justin's making the point that, you know, really, you know, this book obviously is set in a very early period. It sounds like the time of the patriarchs. And God's revelation is obviously not by a long shot complete. And a lot of what God has revealed, he has revealed through creation, you know, through the natural order. That's the reason that in the book of Proverbs, it can say, look at the ant and you can learn not to be lazy. All right? Because if you're not lazy, you'll be taken care of. All right? So we might not think about those terms, but that's the law of sowing and reaping, right? In fact, in the example of the ant, it's literally the law of sowing and reaping. You know, look at the ant. It takes care of itself, puts stuff away for the winter. So, yeah, that's kind of what they've been, you know, what they have come to learn from creation itself. Darren, did I cut you off short a minute ago? Yeah, Darren's making the point.
That's really what the whole book's about.
Yeah, you know, the friends early on were kind of nice. And then it just spiraled out of control. It escalated quickly, all right? But with Elihu, he's been just sitting here apparently steaming the whole time. So, yeah, he comes out kind of both guns blazing, for sure. Yeah, Brad? Very good question. In 35:2, do you think this to be just? Do you say it is my right before God? I don't think, not directly, that Elihu is saying, Job, you think you're more righteous than God. But what he is saying is, it is my right to have God come before me and defend himself. You know, explain what's going on here. Yeah. Now, other times, Elihu does basically say, do you think you're better than God, no more than God, etc. Yeah. All right, well, let's move on here. Great comments, really. All the way around here. All right, so the next section here of chapter 36, starting at verse 5. What principle, of course, this gives it away, right? What principle does Elihu affirm in these verses? Even if you've not paid any attention at all, you know by this point it's the only principle we've talked about, principle of retribution. And you can see it very clearly here when he says in verse 11, if they listen and serve him, they complete their days in prosperity and their years in pleasantness. But if they do not listen, they perish by the sword and die without knowledge. So yeah, Elihu is firmly in the camp of what we have called, for those of you visiting with us, what Scripture sometimes calls the law of sowing and reaping. It is often referred to as the principle of retribution. You get paid back what you've done. And that's the principle that this book is really revolving around, because Job is the outlier. He's the exception. He is not a wicked man. And yet he seems to be suffering as if he's being paid back for evil. All right, look at verses 13 through 16. The godless in heart cherish anger, and they do not cry for help when he binds them. They die in youth, and their life ends among the cult prostitutes. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction and opens their ear by adversity. He also will urge you out of distress into a broad place where there was no cramping, and set on your table, and what was set on your table was full of fatness. In these verses, what is Elihu saying about the way in which God opens up our ears to listen to him? How does he say God does that? By adversity. That's right. You can see it clearly in verse 15. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction, and he opens their ear by adversity. And this, I would say, is another one of his big themes. I think one of them is God is unapproachable. None of us can go before him. And I think another big theme is God uses suffering to get us to repent, to turn back to him. He said the same thing back in 33:19. Do you remember this is the part where he says, Job, God speaks to us two ways. One of them is terrible dreams. And the other way is through suffering. As he says in verse 19, man is also rebuked with pain on his bed. And as I've said before, not everything Elihu says is wrong. So think about this point. Does God use adversity sometimes to get our attention? Of course he does. The Bible's filled with examples of this. And Hebrews chapter 12 pointedly teaches it, that those whom God loves, he disciplines like a father who loves his son, and we shouldn't despise his instruction. So yes, God does in fact sometimes use adversity to get our attention. I mentioned last week C.S. Lewis's famous description of pain as God's megaphone. It's how God gets our attention. And certainly, I think most people who are oriented toward God, most people of faith, when we encounter things that remind us of our vulnerability, when we encounter things that remind us of the fragile nature of life and the fact that someday it will come to an end, I think most of us see suffering as kind of a splash of cold water to get us to think more clearly and soberly about eternal things. That's one of the ways God, in fact, can make good come out of evil things, is by helping us through those things to come to think about him more deeply. However, the issue is, in this case, is that what's going on here? Now, you know, kind of like Justin's making the point, you know, to be fair to Elihu, there's just not been a lot revealed that he has as information to go by here, right? And to be fair to Elihu and the friends and to Job, from the opening two chapters, we as the readers are privy to far more information than any of them are right at this moment in the development of the book, right? I mean, we've seen this whole scene unfold up in the presence of God and the sons of God and the accuser, and we know that this is showing that in fact, there are people who fear God. Even though they lose everything, they still will fear him. So we're privy to a lot. So to be fair to Elihu, yeah, it's not true in this case. This is not what's going on in the story of Job. But you can certainly understand why he would say this, given what he has to work with. Yeah. Right.
She's having to deal with over a long period of time doesn't mean that she's done anything wrong. And I just think that should be clarified.
Oh, no, yeah, it's something we talked about this a lot, you know, in classes and sermons as we encounter suffering, that quite honestly, the mistake Job's friends and Elihu make is a narrow list of options to explain why suffering happens. That's really kind of the whole point of this book, right? The simple answers don't always work. They don't work in this case. And that's what, seems like that's what everybody's looking for, right? They want the simple answer. Just like that's what we want. It's what I want. You know, just come with a simple answer. Life is more complicated, more interesting, more subtle than that, for sure. Yeah, Andrew?
So I just...
Oh, I'm sorry, hang on a second. So just to double down on Vicky's point here, think about the classic illustration that shows suffering sometimes has nothing at all to do with the sufferer's character or anything else. The classic example of this, the blind man in John 9. He was born blind. And they, just in terms of you know, the ordinary human story, you know, here's a man who's born blind. And remember, what's the question the disciples ask of Jesus? Yeah, whose fault is this? Did this man sin or did his parents sin? And Jesus says, neither one. Wrong answers. It's to display the glory of God. Yeah, Andrew?
So just out of curiosity, just because it seems like kind of a random charge when he's talking about the godless of heart, they lay up their anger, they do not cry for help, they die in youth, and their life perishes among the cult prostitutes. That's what kind of stood out to me, because it's such an odd description of the world.
Yeah.
The only thing that kind of immediately comes to mind is that maybe this is a slam against Job's children, that, well, clearly they were wicked, they were, Curious if there's a reason why they
Yeah, y'all see what Andrew's asking about there in 36:14. They die in youth, their life ends among the cult prostitutes. And of course, when you talk about young people dying, it'd be hard if you were Job not to at least think a little bit about his children. I think probably Elihu's point here is, if these people who are dying are wicked, they are so wicked, they've gone up to the shrines that are like the epitome of wickedness. And so I think his point really, it's just a very powerful way of saying they really deserve what they're getting. I mean, it's a real strong form of the principle of retribution here. I mean, they're up with these cult prostitutes. Of course they deserved to die even in youth. Yeah.
What he's saying is they didn't repent. They're not listening to God. They're just going all out into sin. They don't care what God has to say, so they're going to go right down the toilet. And what he's trying to tell him is, if you don't
yeah, that's a great point, Gary. The whole point of him bringing this up is to say, look, God is using adversity to open your ear up to listen, and the people who don't, this is what ends up happening to them. So, Job, time for you to listen up. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Dean.
Mm-hmm. Even Cain's family cursed.
Right.
And then, you know, then Adam and Eve had another, and that set on all the way to the Tower of Babel. I mean, in other words, regardless of where you put him, all the way through Moses, he's got major points. This is the way things work. They've got to set
correct
in order. And I really thought that his point about the crying out was trying to emphasize that man should be humble because of sin. You know, Job is not perfect in the sense of sin.
Right. Yeah.
And he made that point in the other chapter, just the idea that who cries out? Those that are oppressed, and we're crying out because they need it. And then, but who's going to cry out when the cross comes? And Job clearly is saying, listen, I can go before God. But how did Moses act when going before God? How did
sure right. Well, you know, Dean's making the point that we saw this throughout the speeches of the friends, where at various points the friends will say things like, man is utterly sinful. Who are you to think you could stand, you know, in his sight? Which sounds great. Job says, you know, I could talk like you if I was in your position. Yeah, it's easy to say that when everything's going well. Yeah. But no, based on the opening chapters of the Bible, we have, again, this concept of when you do bad, bad things happen to you. And that's why it's so hard to wrap our minds around this. All right, now I want to move on here. The next question, I have to apologize. This was a very poorly worded question. I think this was one Nathan suggested I asked, maybe. I think no. But because it's not a helpful way to ask the question. What does Job not have the right to do according to verses 17 through 23? Well, what I was getting at, really, and maybe somehow you managed to navigate your way through the haze to figure out what I was talking about, was verse 23, where Elihu says, who has prescribed for him his way or can say you have done wrong? So what I was getting at is Elihu is saying, Job, you don't have the right to do something. Namely, you don't have the right to go to God and say you've done wrong. You don't have the right to call God on the carpet. That's what I was getting at. I just didn't ask the question very well. All right, now, starting at verse 24 and really going through most of chapter 37, what does Elihu start talking about?
How to get back with God.
And what did you say, Dave? The greatness of God displayed in the storm, what else?
Rain.
In other words, the greatness of God seen in?
His creation.
Yes, the creation. That is exactly right. And I ask you to list the different elements, and you all are doing that, right? So he mentions the rain, like in verse 27. If you go on into chapter 37, thunder and lightning, snow, and so forth. So So this is what Elihu, when he's trying to explain the point that God is great and awesome, and so we don't have a right to basically say, you got to come and answer to me for what you're doing. The way he gets that across is by his reference to creation. Now, here is the thing that I want you to see. However it is, we're supposed to look at Elihu. You know, is he a pompous blowhard, or is he doing as good as any man could do to get to the truth? Whichever way you take it. Here is the reason why I think his speeches are included in the book. Because they end with his description of creation. And when God starts to speak in the next chapter, what's the focus of his speech going to be? Yeah, it's going to be the creation itself. Right. So Elihu's speeches are the perfect introduction, the perfect transition from what he's been saying to what God says. Now, having said that, you all already hinted at this, actually. When he talks about the creation, what does he get out of it about God? What are the lessons he's learning about God as he reflects on creation?
God is unknowable.
Yeah, God's unknowable and he's great. None of us could ever possibly know him. Those are the lessons he learns. So, if in the very next chapter, 38 and 39, God's going to talk about creation, it only stands to reason that Bible students would think to themselves, okay, I wonder if God is going to draw the same kinds of lessons, or is God going to draw out any different lessons than what Elihu is drawing out about what can be known about God through creation? And you can just guess that I think he's going to draw some different lessons. All right? There are part of what's going to be about the same issue here of the greatness of God, but there's going to be some other things as well. All right, look at verses 19 through 24. What's the essence, would you say, of Elihu's conclusion here? All right, those are all the good points, especially for a pro-Elihu person like Vicky is down here. Yeah, so God is powerful, he's made the creation, and he won't do anything wrong. I think those are all good things. Notice verses 23 and 24 of 37. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice and abundant righteous, he will not violate. Therefore men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceits. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Who do you think he has in mind? Yeah, obviously Job, right? Now, if I had to give one and only one reason why I have a negative view of Elihu, it would be this. He just got through saying God is unapproachable and he doesn't regard us. Certainly not you. And what's the very next thing that happens in the book? Look at verse 1 of the next chapter. Yeah, the Lord appears to Job in a whirlwind. Right after Elihu says, God's unapproachable, and it's certainly not going to give you the time of day, Job. Who shows up? And not only is this against what Elihu has said, the friends kept saying the same thing, right? God's never going to listen to you. He's never going to answer you. You don't have any right. Now, to be fair, it says, as you know already from your study of Job, when the Lord shows up, does Job sit down and ask him 25 questions? Who does the talking? Yeah, the Lord does the talking. Right? So to be fair, we want to point that out. It's not like Job gets to actually engage in his trial. He quickly withdraws it by the time the Lord gets done with just his first speech. All right, but that is one thing that I do think we have to take into account. All right, now, the last thing I asked you for tonight was, and this is blank. So, having read Elihu's speeches, what do you make of him? Is he any closer to the truth than the friends of Job? Explain your answer in 2,500 words or less, all right? So what do you think about this guy?
He thinks he's a little wiser.
All right, that's right, Dave. He does think he's wiser. Are you convinced? I mean, if you were, make your best case, what new insight has Elihu given to us? Now, if I wanted to argue in his favor, what I would say is this. It is true that Eliphaz, in his first speech, way back in chapters 4 and 5, that Eliphaz does say something along the lines of, hey, you know, Job, maybe what's going on here is God just wants to get your attention. He does say something like that. I will say, trying to give Elihu every bit of fairness possible, that's certainly a bigger part of what he says than anybody else so far. I don't think it's novel with him, but he does seem to say, look, God can get your attention and can use suffering to make you a better person. Now, the way he frames it is, he makes you a better person by using suffering to get you to turn away from the evil you're doing. All right? And that's the big flaw with what he says, at least with regard to the case of Job himself. But I do think that there is probably some legitimacy to that as a slightly different perspective than anybody else has given. Yeah, John? Yeah.
I have a lot more pity for those men, and I think they, to their credit, get a whole lot more out of what they've been revealed with, understanding and putting the pieces together, than sometimes we do.
Yeah.
And I just find it amazing to me that they get where they get.
Yeah.
And I do understand the errors, but I also understand the way that they thought and the amount of
Yeah.
Just wasn't much.
Yeah. I think we all feel that way, really honest. I mean, I hope we do. I mean, I hope we all feel sympathetic to everybody in the book. You know, and I've tried to, as you know, early on when we talked about the friends, I tried to really make the point. Until I go and sit 7 days and seven nights and say nothing to show love to a brother, I'm not in a great position to judge what any of these men say. The only time that I think they deserve to be faulted is when they cross the line and they literally start inventing out of thin air sins that Job's guilty of. That's when that's just a step too far at that point. Elihu does it a little bit when he says Job keeps company with wicked people, but he doesn't do it to the extent that the others do. John, I think that you're exactly right here. That I think we should all be sympathetic. Just as we should be sympathetic with each other when we are on the ash heap, like Job, and one of us starts lashing out. I think that the key underlying mistake of all of them, and Mickey, we talked just a little bit after class last week, and I can't remember if you said this to me or somebody else did, but I think in a sense, the mistake that Job, his friends, and Elihu all make is they think they have to be spokesmen for God. That's exactly, remember Elihu, we read it tonight. That's what he says he is. I'm here to speak for God, right? And Job has already accused the friends of being like the campaign spokesperson when he says, you're whitewash. You're just painting everything God does. And then Job thinks that he's supposed to say, obviously God, it doesn't really matter to him. Good and evil, it's all the same. You know, he doesn't care. They all think that they've got to speak for God. And I think that's one of the things that we all, by the way, you guys with comments, can you remember them when we start next class? Just while I was wrapping up here, I have to say stuff. I'm to the age now where if I don't say it while I'm thinking it, I'm going to forget it here. So, but I think that, that's the thing we all have to be on guard against. It's one thing to say, thus says the Lord. It's another thing to say, I know exactly why God's doing this. Those are two different things, right? And the first one we ought to do. Thus says the Lord, we need to preach the book. But the second one, when we start saying, well, I know exactly why this is happening. That's a whole different, you know, can of worms. And I think that everybody in the book at different times is claiming that they've got that knowledge. Either Job by saying, well, because God doesn't really care. Or the friends, well, obviously the law of retribution, same with Elihu. And one of the big takeaways, I think, from what we're going to learn from the Lord's speeches is, look, I run the world for its purposes according to laws, but the laws don't run me. And don't ever confuse those two. All right? All right, well, yeah, if you all can hang on to those comments, and that's we'll start next week. Now, first of all, I appreciate your preparation and your feedback. And I really tried to arrange class so we could really take our time working through what I think we're supposed to work through, the highlight of the book, which are the Lord's speeches. They are magnificent. So please be sure to read ahead for next time as we start to work through those.